Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul. Actually, we don't have Paul with us again today. And so I know you may go through your Paul Venable withdrawals today. And so you're stuck with me and my my astute reading skills. Or that's not even a proper explanation. As I was telling Paul, a long, long time ago, I learned, you know, how to read fast. And, you know, they used to have the Evelyn Wood speed reading dynamics. And I don't know, I'm maybe aging myself by saying that. But anyway, I learned at a point where, you know, how to skim through and not really read stuff to be able to garner stuff. And that kind of helped. It helped a lot in me being able to digest stuff. And what I realized was I actually get more out of books, audiobooks, than I do out of reading, because I get the full detail, I get the imagery, that type of stuff. So I really became a real connoisseur of audiobooks. Now, when it came to textbooks, you know, for school and stuff like that, I would just be able to skim through it and, you know, be able to find exactly what I was looking for, and then I would dig into the details. But one of the things that happens when I actually read out loud, because I have to articulate what I'm trying to say and reading the words, because I wanted to say, you know, nobody wants to say something and make a mistake, right? So anyway, as I go through this, I slow down my reading to a point where I actually find myself making the biggest mistake you can make while you're reading. Because what you have to do it well, is you really got to focus. And I have a hard time focusing. Not that I suffer immensely from ADD, but I just, even at this age, I'm constantly thinking of other things. I hope my wife's doing okay. I know she's doing this, you know, or what are the dogs doing? Is my grass growing? And I long for the day when I can actually, you know, just sit out and watch the grass grow and really not think of anything. You know, I envy people that have the opportunity to go out and fish or do things like that, to where, you know, it's just you're out in the day, you're enjoying it, and you're doing something you enjoy, and you don't have to think. As a matter of fact, there's a good video that identifies the uniqueness of how the sexes, I don't want to say gender, because that's a, gender has become a really dirty word. So how the sexes actually operate. And the guy had this ball, or actually had a box that was just stuffed with, you know, string that was just a mess, because it was just, you know, and I know this infuriates the ladies out there, but, and I'm not trying to do that, but, you know, guys actually have the ability of actually thinking about nothing. And so there's a lot of great sitcom that actually kind of, you know, circles around that. One of my favorite shows that my wife and I would watch, actually, and one of the things I'll tell you, you may not like it if you've seen it, and it may not be in your, in your will or in your taste, but we always watched Everybody Loves Raymond. And that's because it happens to be a show that's really centered on the dynamics and relationships of people. And there's only, I think, two or three episodes where there is even a mention or even visibility of a cell phone or that type of technology. I mean, there's a computer. So it's not, you know, about anything that is modern. It is about the, you know, the personalities and how people think and operate. And it's a really well done show. So well that we're able to actually watch that, kind of decompress, and it puts us in, you know, a state of mind where we can actually go to bed. Because, I mean, if you've got a lot of things on your mind, you need to do something to kind of clear that. Because if you're like me, when I hit the bed and I'm thinking about stuff, I'm not sleeping. And I can toss and turn for hours and not sleep at all. So we use Everybody's Loves Raymond to clear our minds. Anyway, there's a point in the episodes or different episodes where Raymond keeps on saying, you know, there's not a lot going on up here. And there's a lot to be said about that. I mean, it's not that he's stupid, but it, you know, he plays that, you know, he doesn't think too much. He just does. Anyway, I digress. We are going through the Hamilton plan. There's about a little less than 4 pages to go. And I'm going to try to make sure I inject some things. But this is actually a pretty good, I'll say, detail of what Hamilton was saying and what Hamilton was doing and Madison's interpretation. Now, when I say interpretation, because he states some things in here where it's an observation by him, and I'll point out a couple, but the point is this really gives you a flavor of Hamilton's thinking. Now, the guy was very, very smart. He was very literate. I was going to say illiterate. But he had, I think, you know, the influences, or I think he was beholden to people, because it seemed pretty apparent that he was pursuing a quality of life and a standard of life that required more money than he could earn as a lawyer or what have you. And back in those days, lawyers did not make much money. The only promise that a lawyer had was the promise that they would be able to serve in government, those types of things. So anyway, as we look at what Hamilton is pitching, we kind of already covered yesterday, Paul and I, we covered Hamilton's assessment of the two plans and his criticisms of them. And so moving on, I kind of want to reread one part, this little couple of sentences to kind of move in, because he's just now closing out kind of his criticism regarding the other plans, the Pinckney plan and the Virginia plan or the New Jersey plan. And so this is Hamilton, or actually Madison reciting or remembering what Hamilton said. Bad principles in government, though slow, are sure in their operation and will gradually destroy it. A doubt has been raised whether Congress at present have a right to keep ships or troops in peacetime. He leans to the negative. Because if you really look at the Articles of Federation, they don't possess the ability to have and maintain a navy or even an army. It's all based on the states. And he says, Mr. P's plan provides no remedy. If the powers proposed were adequate, the organization of Congress is such that they could never be properly and effectually exercised. The members of Congress, being chosen by the states and subject to recall, represent all the local prejudices. Should the powers be found effectual, they will from time to time be heaped on them till a tyrannic sway shall be established. The general power, whatever be its form, if it preserves itself, must swallow up the state powers. Otherwise, it will be swallowed up by them. It is against all the principles of good government to vest the requisite powers in such a body as Congress. Two sovereignties cannot coexist with the same limits. Giving powers to Congress must eventuate in a bad government or in no government. The plan of the New Jersey, therefore, will not do. What then is to be done? And so this is Madison injecting with this little phrase, he seemed embarrassed. So he's basically making an assessment in the theatrics of Hamilton that Hamilton seemed embarrassed. And so he goes on and says, the extent of the country to be governed discouraged him. Another observation. Not anything he basically said. It was just an observation. The expense of a general government was also formidable unless there was such a diminution of expense on the side of the state governments as the case would admit. If they were extinguished, he was persuaded that great economy could be obtained by substituting a general government. He did not mean, however, to shock the public opinion by proposing such a measure. On the other hand, he saw no necessity for declining it. They are not necessary for any of the great purpose of commerce, revenue, or agriculture. Subordinate authorities, he was aware, would be necessary. They must be district tribunals, corporations for local purposes. But cui bono, and I have no idea what that means, maybe it's Latin probably, the vast and expensive apparatus now appertaining to the states. The only difficulty of a serious nature which occurred to him was that of drawing representatives from the extremes to the center of the community. Now, see, he's referring to the national government as a community, and this has been framed by many of the other framers. As a matter of fact, I believe Wilson, in the ratification debates and other points, really did talk about communities and use that metaphor as you've got the state community and now the national community. And as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, even Madison used those same types of metaphors. What inducements can be offered that will suffice? The moderate wages for the first branch would only be a bait to little demagogues. $3 or thereabouts, he supposed, would be the utmost. The Senate, he feared, from a similar cause, would be filled with certain undertakers who wish for particular offices under the government. This view of the subject almost led him to despair that a Republican government could be established over so great an extent. He was sensible at the same time. Now, see, here's the interesting thing. This paradigm that a Republican form of government could not operate in such a large body. As a matter of fact, the Anti-Federalists constantly used that, and it was brought up. I believe Montesquieu was probably, if I looked, I would probably find instances of the references of Montesquieu in Madison's notes. Because Montesquieu basically said Republican forms of government operate best at a small scale. Now, Montesquieu looked at a Republican form of government as a sole government. In other words, let me explain this. When you look at your county government, it is the sole government of that county. But actually, we've created a system in this Constitution, and the divine origin of our constitutional framework actually creates two layers of government on top of your county government. Now, the only interface with the federal government in your county would be maybe your militia when we look at the Constitution, but there's still some federal attachment to your county. Even though the federal attachment would really go through the state, because the federal government would basically create a commission, or basically call forth the militia and give execution orders to particular states. Now, if your state was in the heap of the trouble, then your militia would already be engaged, and then the federal government would be bringing in additional militia from other states. The closer the states are, probably the greater the burden. And the further the states are, probably the less. I mean, If you went further away, you may pull in subject matter experts or unique resources, artillery, ships, or what have you, to bring in, you know, to fight or to engage whatever that problem is. And the problem is only one of three things that the Constitution allows. In other words, the federal government cannot go in because there is, a natural disaster. The federal government can only go in if there's an insurrection, an invasion, like what's going on our southern border, or the execution of laws. In other words, the people are resistant to the execution of the law, like the Whiskey Rebellion. And the Whiskey Rebellion demanded federal intervention because it became an insurrection as well. So civil disobedience and or riotous behavior are the two that would force the federal government to mobilize the militia. They have no other reason other than the invasion for the federal government to basically come and you make acquisitions or requisitions against the state to pull people out of your county to go serve the cause of the nation. So the limitations and your taxation, those types of things, and that was pretty minute. So the involvement and one's feeling of the intrusion of the federal government at your county level was very, very minimal. I mean, it was it wasn't even noticed by the people for a century, for the most part. Now, the state government, it had an overlay over your county as well. But it should have been a general government as well. But the way we created the framework, we screwed up. But we can fix it. But we have to start creating constitutions for your county. Now, we'll go through those details a little bit more, but what I'm trying to say is Montesquieu did not envision a three-tiered Republican form of government, that at the county, it would be Republican in form, that at the state, it would be Republican in form, and at the federal, it would be Republican in form, and there would be a delineation of where the powers lied. Now, for some reason and somehow, the powers that actually belong in your county have been sucked up to the federal government. Now, and forgive me for going on this little, journey here with you, but as Jefferson described the political energies of this framework, of the Constitution and the way it was to operate, he basically described our government as the political energy of our government as distributive or centrifugal. And I believe they actually use the word centrifugal and centripetal. And centrifugal means that it's outward flowing, distributive, and that the energy actually reposits or deposits itself in the furthest reaches in the republic. In other words, to the counties. In a centripetal or in a centralized or a top-down government, because we have a bottom-up government, that's why the political energy is outward at the county level. In a top-down government, the power, or I should say the political energy, is drawing all political energy to the center. This is why and how the federal government has unconstitutionally assumed all sorts of powers that actually belong in your county. And they had the aid of the states to do this. That nobody thought as they were creeping along, nobody thought until probably, I would say, in the mid-1800s, this is when, and probably after, right after the Civil War, and as things started going a little bit, sideways, actually because of the Organic Act and so forth. But my point is this, that as we, hit that Organic Act and things really started going sideways, this is when there were people in power that decided and unconstitutionally changed the political energy of America, where they started seeking and actually centralizing power as much as possible at the federal level or can, you know, getting the states to do it, and then the states basically handing it over to the federal government. And so this is why today education is ran from the federal government. Housing, labor, I mean, energy, all sorts of things are being manipulated and managed by a government that has no authority to do any of it. How did that happen? Well, it's our fault because we allowed ourselves to become illiterate. You know, folks, everything I've learned never came from a classroom. Never came from a teacher. Well, I shouldn't say didn't come from another person, you know, like a mentor or what have you. I've had lots of people. I mean, I've had the privilege of working with people that have become subject matter experts. I mean, you know, Bob Schultz on the First Amendment petition. I myself didn't really think the petition was that critical in our process. And not that I discarded it. I just didn't think I looked at Republic Review as really the only answer. But the thing that was lacking is how do we get there? So as we, you know, as I started meeting people and having these conversations with Bob Schultz, then I realized, well, we have to integrate and we have to rely heavily upon the First Amendment petition. Now, as I also was reaching out, I've also learned another thing that I'm not a subject matter expert on common law, but I've learned enough to know that it is also integral. And so we have to use petitions to actually start moving our county in the right direction. And in that process of in the right direction, we actually have to restore common law courts. We have to restore our militia and our law enforcement. We do not want to, nor do we have to restore the doctrine of magistrates. We do not want to wipe out our representative government. But we have a responsibility, we the people, if we're going to create a big government where we're going to have, you know, our fingers in everything at the county level, then we the people either pay ourselves or we at least have to volunteer because this is a self-government. The last thing you want is to elect princes and princesses or kings and queens to rule you in your county. That's the whole point of why we're not electing a sheriff to be our ruler. We may need to expand our county commissioners, our county legislators. We should have a county executive, not an executive to rule us, but an executive to ensure that all parties within the county are adhering to this county constitution and the law. And as long as the law is congruent with the state and federal constitutions, we're good. We need some leadership, but we don't need to be paying through the teeth for big government. You know, this, if you look at why counties matter most, and I did not integrate this, but I will integrate this into the petition because this is where we really start talking about the plan. And so when we really dive into the petition and the right of the First Amendment petition, that's the next article coming up. And in it, I actually, you know, lay out the strategy of how to move your county from one person helping, you know, become the leader or the town crier and moving people to unite in making your county constitutional. Because the last thing you want are foreigners coming in and ruling you, because that's the direction we're heading. Because bottom line, no American is going to inflict the level of tyranny necessary to get America into control with the globalists. Because we're way too free still. I mean, even though our kids have been indoctrinated and weaponized to actually surrender their liberty, they do have a chance of waking up. They do have the opportunity of coming to their senses if you, as parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, actually start doing your job in educating them. And the best thing you can do is you can teach them the color-coded Constitution. But When we come back, I'm going to get back to where I left off with the Senate and Hamilton's muses. Again, we're just going to a promo. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so hopefully that kind of made sense of, you know, this Montesquieu Republican form of government and where the real power lies, because Montesquieu, you know, wasn't really, because you got to understand, folks, when we say we the people, that is a democratic form of government paradigm, unless you start qualifying it. And we have to qualify and qualify and qualify to really get, you know, the proper perspective of the government that was bestowed upon us. Because the government we have today, the rulers, these tyrants that are in office today, many of them don't even know that they're tyrants. They just think, oh, this is how it is. I have these powers. No. But the government that we have with we the people as a bottom-up strategy, not as a democracy, but as a Republican form of government, that we do not create our own laws. You know, I deal with, you know, people that really consider themselves, you know, great. I'm going to say this. There's a lot of people that actually have money that, you know, drive what they would call great initiatives. In the state of Washington, there's, and the guy's, I think, his intent is honorable. His name's Brian Haywood. He has self-funded these six initiatives in trying to stop bad government. But what he's doing is he's using the form of democracy. Here's a guy that actually, for the money he spent on actually getting these initiatives on the ballot, and by the way, three are making it, the hurdles were sought and obtained. In other words, all the signatures, everything was done for these six initiatives. Now the legislature, because these three initiatives really attack some of their pet projects of social engineering, such as, you know, parental rights. The legislature is doing this big investigation to determine whether these petitions are legitimate. And now there's this outcry. I mean, this is absolute democracy going sideways here in the state of Washington. Because I'm hearing Republicans call upon people to actually, you know, contact your representatives and, you know, invoke, you know, your, or at least tell them your sentiments. You know what? You complaining to government is not a First Amendment petition. A First Amendment, Brian Haywood, listen to this. Complaining to government is nothing. Trying to drive initiatives and using democracy is a violation of the Constitution. Legislative powers are vested in our legislators. We have to hold them accountable. The process is not saying, well, if they won't do what we want, then we're going to do it ourselves. You know, two wrongs don't make a right. The mechanism that nobody's been taught over the past century plus is to actually use First Amendment petitions to hold them accountable to the law. So, anywho. I'm sorry for digressing. I'll stop myself right there instead of going back down another rat hole. But the bottom line is every state has these really good people. And, you know, their hearts are in the right spot. And their intent is there's no doubt in my mind, this man is a noble man. But because he has been, I believe he went to Harvard. He's a very educated man. He's just illiterate on the Constitution and our form of government. That's all I can say. All I can say. Anyway. Getting back to what Madison's recount of Hamilton's basically projection of his plan. The Senate, he feared, from a similar cause, would be filled by certain undertakers who wish for particular offices under the government. This view of the subject almost led him to despair that a Republican government could be established over a great extent. He was sensible at the time that it would be unwise to propose one of any other form. In his private opinion, he had no scruple in declaring and supported he as he was by the opinions of so many of the wise and good that the British government was the best in the world, and he doubted much better anything sort of it would do in America. Boom. He just played his card. The British government was the best government in the world. And that we couldn't do anything but do what they've done or be a part of them to succeed. He hoped gentlemen of different opinions would bear with him in this and beg them to recollect the change of opinion on the subject which had taken place and was going on. It was once thought that the power of Congress was amply sufficient to secure the end of their institution. The error was now seen by everyone. The members most tenacious of republicanism, he observed, were as loud as any disclaiming against the vices of democracy. This progress of the public mind led him to anticipate the time when others as well as himself would join in the praise bestowed by Mr. Necker on the British Constitution, namely, that it is only government in the world, quote, which unites public strength with individual security, close quote. In every community where industry is encouraged, there will be a division of it into the few and the many. Hence, separate interests will arise. There will be debtors and creditors, and etc. Give all power to the many, they will oppress the few. Give all power to the few, they will oppress the many. Both, therefore, ought to have power that each may defend against the other. To the want of this check, we owe our paper money, installment laws, and etc. To the proper adjustment of the British owe the excellence of their constitution. Their House of Lords is a most notable institution, having nothing to hope for by a change and sufficient interest by means of their property in being faithful to the national interest. They form a permanent barrier against every pernicious innovation, whether attempted on the part of the Crown or of the Commons. Now, he's really making this, you know, he's trying to sell this concept of the British legislative process between the Commons, the Lords, and the King. But the reality is, in the British law, at this point in time of history, the King and the monarchy have not stepped aside. They have not really placed a barrier. It wasn't until much later, in the 1800s or 1900s, when they finally established a prime minister and the monarchies kind of stepped back. But the monarchies did not just step back. or I should say they didn't remove themselves. They did not divorce themselves from government. As a matter of fact, the people demanded that the monarchs be maintained. And today, the Commonwealth of Britain all around the world pays tribute to the British monarchs. A percentage of their taxes goes to the monarch and the monarch structure of Britain. So just so you know, folks, the British Empire still exists. It never was dismantled. And at any point in time, there's no doubt in my mind, they have in some dark, dank, you know, recess of a castle somewhere, they have this little glass box break in case of emergency so that the crown can seize all power. Why? Because at some point in time, Hamilton basically says their form of government will fail, and that the monarch, because many people of this time and most people historically have stated that the best government, not knowing God's government or what God had inspired in our Constitution and our framework, they believed that a noble monarch was the best government for the people on earth. It was the best type of government you could have. That all sets the stage for the setup of the Antichrist to actually become the noble monarch of earth. As we start moving towards a global government, everything is laying into place, and the European monarchs, how many of them are there? Go count how many, and go count how many by the crowns in Revelations is assessed or attributed or counted. What is the total of crowns? I think it's like 10, 13, and 1. So go out and count. And then look at what we have today. And, you know, things are lining up. As I said the other day, these are the days of solar flares, solar eclipses, and so forth. I mean, anyway, let me move on. Hamilton then goes on and says, no temporary Senate will have firmness enough to answer the purpose. The Senate of Maryland, which seems to be so much appealed to, has not yet been sufficiently tried. Had the people been unanimous and eager in the late appeal to them on the subject of paper emissions, they would have yielded to the torrent. Their acquiescing in such an appeal is a proof of it. Gentlemen differ in their opinions concerning the necessary checks from the different estimates they form of the human passions. They suppose 7 years a sufficient period to give the Senate an adequate firmness from not duly considering the amazing violence and turbulence of the democratic spirit. When a great object of government is pursued which seizes the popular passions, they spread like wildfire and become irresistible. Now, let me just build on what he just said. They're talking about having a 7 years to basically kind of have this, you know, long-term firmness of, you know, members in the Senate. And so what Hamilton basically states, because he talks about, and the framers understood the democratic spirit and how it could become very destructive or productive, depending on its movement. And this is what he says, when a great object of government is pursued, which seizes, in other words, so what we have right now, folks, and what he's describing is an object of government. We have one movement right now that's been out in the streets. It's called the Bolshevik Revolution. It is a movement to topple America's law and America's form of government into the final throes and the final transition of communism. They have been going and using, and this is why we have democracy. This is why we are illiterate on the Constitution, because they've gradually and incrementally instilled and established these principles, these communist principles in America, all unconstitutional, all illegal. But they're telling you this is all legitimate. They have the powers because the two parties agreed that they could do these things. The other passion of government is you, the patriots. But the problem is you're all divided, which is why we have gone out of our way to prove to you that the party cannot be trusted because it has ambitions. The party has agendas. The party is not the advocate for the Constitution. There's not one party out there right now that is what I consider at the top of the political sphere, where they are purely constitutional, that they don't have these agenda platforms and platitudes. What they have is direct focus that the Constitution must be fully complied to. There is no agendas. The federal government cannot do anything other than what is enumerated, and the same applies to your state. That's simple. I mean, I couldn't make a platform any more simpler. Bottom line. When a party finally gets there to actually lead, then that's the party we go with. And we all have to understand what is in the Constitution so we can hold each other accountable. It's kind of like as we all start understanding Christianity and we actually start understanding what is sin, then we can start helping each other saying, you know, that I think that might be a sin. You know, and it's up to you, not to the body of people, to keep you from sinning. Did Christ keep the adulteress from sinning? No, he said, go and sin no more. So let's be clear. As we look at the two movements, those who want to destroy this nation and those who want to save it, we have this diametric opposition. On the destruction side, they are all united and they are working together. They're not divided at all. This is why they're so successful. This is why we've gotten where we are today, because of their focus. All we have to do is put aside the agenda, put aside the political agenda of the party, put aside the desire to use the court system, which has been proven to be corrupt, and say, we're not doing this with the court. We're doing this by the will of the people. We demand compliance, and we're holding our courts, our judges, and our legislators, our executives. We're holding all people who take an oath. And this is that divine nature of why we even have the oath. In England, they didn't have the oath. And the reason why is because the king was anointed by God. He was chosen, and that could not be revoked. And that is the perversion of the design. Now, when we look at, you know, the different paths, okay, so we've proven that the party is not the path. We've proven that the court's not the path. We've also proven that nullification, ignoring the laws, no, we have to hold them accountable and stop and arrest, interpose all of the laws that are violations and get rid of them. The only process of nullification is when we, the states, and we, the people of the counties, get the states of this republic to actually force the federal government to, you know, not just acknowledge, but to dismantle and destroy all unconstitutional government with the directive that they will never do it again without the states granting them those powers. It's that simple. So, you know, and I everybody looks at, well, yeah, I've really boiled it down. I've distilled this, but there are lots of steps. And what we have to do is we have to start with our county government. We have to start holding them accountable, and we actually have to start working together to create a county constitution. We need leaders in the county that want to be held accountable and want to help lead in creating a good, limited government county constitution. Just be forewarned, the more power you give government, the more opportunity they have to be tyrannical. A limited and defined government has been proven to be the best. Whatever Hamilton is saying here, we now have empirical data that proves him wrong. And so I can't emphasize enough. When we look at the two forces, the only reason we are not winning, because we clearly have the numbers, the only reason we're not winning is because those of you listening are ardent supporters of the party. Those of you listening are ardent supporters of our legal system and filing court cases. Those of you, you know, listening are ardent believers in democracy and have turned your back on our Republican form of government. Those of you listening are, you know, supporters of nullification and the anti-conventionites, and have actually gone into this binary convention or nullification. It's the same thing. Those of you listening that are supporters of the Article 5 convention, all of you are a part of the problem. And another big part of the problem are those of you who think that this is all legitimate and I'm going to bail out and I'm not going to be a citizen anymore. So in other words, the Jural Assemblies, the Sovereign Citizen Movement, all of those folks, as well as those who are seeking a convention, as well as those who are focused on, no, we can't do a convention, it's nullification, they're all wrong. They are all wrong. Clearly, the Madison and Thomas Jefferson are yelling from the grave that we must interpose. Many of the framers called upon interposition. We cannot sit idly by and say we have to nullify and we're just going to ignore the laws. We're not going to enforce it. We have to force government into compliance. Government should be at a point where they would recoil and actually, what's the word for it? Where they not just recoil, but they shrivel. And they basically become incapable, impotent, when an unconstitutional law is put before them. There is no reason why. As a matter of fact, not only should we actually be, you know, making it so that our legislators, you know, recoil, they should actually attack that person who thinks that they can put an unconstitutional bill in front of your assembly. We have to stop it. We have to stop allowing people, well, you know, you're going to make some money on this. At whose expense? At what expense? The expense is always too great. As George Washington warned us, never allow government to usurp powers, because this is the common tool of how governments are destroyed. So as I'm going through what Hamilton's talking about, he then appealed to the New England states, this is back to him. He appealed to the gentleman from the New England states, whether experience had not there verified the remark. As to the executive, it seemed to be admitted that no good one could be established on Republican principles. Was not this giving up the merits of the question? For there can be a good government without it. There can be no good government without an executive. The English model was the only good one on this subject. The hereditary interest of the king was so interwoven that that of the nation and his personal emoluments so great that he was placed above the danger of being corrupted. How naive is this guy? From abroad and from the same time, which both sufficiently independent and sufficiently controlled to answer the purpose of the institution at home, one of the weak sides of the republic was their being liable to foreign influence and corruption. Men of little character acquiring great power become easily the tools of intermeddling neighbors. This is something Hamilton had definitely become a tool for an intermeddling neighbor, Britain. Sweden was a striking instance. The French and English had each their parties during the late revolution, which was effected by the predominant influence of the former. What the inference from all of these observations? That we ought to go as far in order to attain stability and permanency as Republican principles will admit. Let one branch of the legislature hold their places for life, or at least during good behavior. Let the executive also be for life, creating classes, creating literally hereditary classes and an aristocracy. This is what Hamilton is putting in front of these men. Hamilton, excuse me, sorry. Hamilton appealed to the feelings of the members present whether a term of 7 years would induce the sacrifice of private affairs, which an acceptance of public trust would require, so as to ensure the services of the best citizens. On this plan, we should have in the Senate permanent a permanent will, a weighty interest, which would answer essential purposes. But it is this Republican government, it will be asked. Yes, if all the magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people or a process of election originating with the people, he was sensible that executive constituted as he proposed would have, in fact, but little of the power and independence that might be necessary. Are you kidding me? This has actually been proven incorrect. On the other hand, a plan of appointing him or them for 7 years, he thought, the executive ought to have but little power. He would be ambitious with the means of making creatures, and as the object of his ambition would be to prolong his power. It is probable in this case of a war he would avail himself of to emerge, to evade or refuse degradation from his place. We've seen that before, and we actually saw this actually happen, but we actually had noble men in most cases. I honestly think Lincoln would have gone more than two terms. I honestly think that he was, you know, even though we may have had a string of kings starting with Jackson, I think Lincoln was going to actualize kingship. And I believe that there were certain things that still had to be in place that became the fruit of the Civil War, the 14th Amendment being probably the largest or the most succulent or the most productive fruit out of that war. Anyway, Hamilton goes on and says, an executive for life has not the motive for forgetting his fidelity and will therefore be a safer depository of power. It will be objected probably that an executive will be an elective monarch and will give birth to the tumults which characterize that form of government. He would reply that monarch is an indefinite term. It marks not either the degree or duration of power. If this executive magistrate would be a monarch for life, the other proposed by the report from the Committee of the Whole would be a monarch for 7 years. The circumstance of being elective was also applicable to both. It had been observed by judicious writers. Well, actually, we'll stop there because we have to. And so I'll come back tomorrow and we'll finish the Hamilton plan. It looks like we got a couple pages still left to go. Let me see here. Yeah, just two pages. Anyway, I'm doing all of this so that you clearly understand how important our Republican form of government is and what we have to do to save it. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.